Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. So this week's show is going to be about more than meets the eye, things that are either more or less than meet the eye, that is to say, nano, micro, and also mind over matter. So let's get rolling. And the first one, rather disturbing data coming down about breast cancer reactivation. Breast cancer is the second most common cancer globally, with most deaths being caused by metastatic disease, often following long periods of clinical dormancy. And that long period of dormancy is interesting. What is it that causes these cells to go into hibernation and become Rip Van Winkle cells? And what wakes them up? Well, one interesting observation that certain researchers made was that the death rates from cancer, from breast cancer, rose during the first 2 years of COVID-19 pandemic. And this was not fully accounted for by the COVID-19 deaths or delayed screening and treatment, although that, of course, did occur. So they had the hypothesis that maybe pulmonary viral infections could somehow trigger the development of metastases from this dormant cancer cells that we already know are there. Now, we have understanding that in a active cancer, there are circulating tumor cells in the bloodstream. We can actually test for those. There are a number of commercial tests that look for circulating tumor cells. There are also tests that look for cancer DNA or compounds, metabolones that are only made by embryonic and cancer cells. So there's lots of ways to look at this. Now, normally, there are T cells called inhibitor cells. They're CD8 cells. And in the case of these dormant cancers, they are sort of there forming an armed guard around those cells activating. So the hypothesis that viral respiratory infections are associated with pulmonary inflammation, that's not even a hypothesis. We know that. But the idea is that when you have inflammation, you have an increase in cytokines, interleukin-6 and interferons. And you also have an expansion of immune cells, neutrophils, macrophages, which are the amoebas that go around eating things, and then the T lymphocytes. And there are signals that cause those neutrophils to wake up. And there's also things that the white blood cells release, specifically the neutrophil extracellular traps, which if you want to imagine throwing out a fishing net into a river or the ocean, the neutrophil, that's the polymorphonuclear cells, the PMNs or polys, not lymphocytes, they explode and they throw out a net, and that net is full of substances that are pro-inflammatory. And they may, in fact, these pro-inflammatory signals may act as growth signals for those dormant metastatic cells that have just been sitting there for 5, 10, sometimes as much as 20 years. So they wanted to study this, and they started out with a mouse model, something called, I'm not going to even go through it, except to say that it's a mouse model of breast cancer dormancy. So in other words, these mice are built to have dormant cancer cells in their breasts. And the idea is, you know, can we wake those up by giving them a sublethal dose of influenza A virus? So the infected mice lost weight and recovered about 2 weeks later, sort of similar to the flu. And they looked at the viral clearance, which was about the same whether you were using regular mice or these special mice. But skipping over a whole lot of technical stuff and kind of cutting to the meat and potatoes here, the lungs of the MMTV mice, the ones that had the dormant cancer cells, were taken out at various periods after this infection and examined for how many HER2 positive cells. HER2 positive cells are one of the types of breast cancer that are very aggressive. And when before the infection, they would see a small number of cells, if they took the breasts and sliced them up and looked at them under a microscope, a small number of isolated cells or maybe a few small clusters of 5 to 10 cells in the lungs. But after doing the infection with the influenza virus, the metastatic burden increased up to a thousandfold. And the number of pulmonary hurt, they started growing, in other words, and they started growing geometrically. And so even 9 months after the infection, there were more, those dormant cancer cells were not still dormant. They had woken up and they were producing a structure that you don't ordinarily see in this mice. So certain genetics had been turned on and woken up, and the cells remained awakened, and more cancers occurred in these mice. So it's preliminary, and we don't have evidence in humans. We do have human cell culture evidence that parallels this, but that is not definitive. However, what can we do about this? Well, for one thing, if I am a breast cancer survivor, particularly if I had positive nodes, I would get my flu shot. I would get my RSV shot. I would try not to get infections. I would be pretty aggressive about hand washing. I would put a mask on. I'd keep a mask in my purse. And if someone was coughing and sneezing on my bus or in my car, I'd put it on. Excuse me, you know, I'm a cancer survivor. I need to protect myself. If somebody gets insulted from you doing that, well, you don't care about that person anyway because they don't care about you. So we've got a couple of emails. We're going to bounce to that before we go diving back into the micro world. This one from Kelly. I've been diagnosed with diverticulitis. I've had 7 flares within 18 months. The last time I had a flare was May of this year, and it lasted over a month. I'm trying to manage it with diet, now removing all white flour and sugar from my diet, and I've never been a big drinker, but also abstaining from the occasional beer or glass of wine. I talked to a surgeon recently about possibly having the infected part of my colon removed, which is scary for me because I know sometimes people end up with a colostomy. We'll come back to that, Kelly. I was wondering if you could talk about diverticulitis, what causes it and how to manage it, and when someone would require surgery. Also, I've been pre-diabetic for about 10 years. I'm 73 years old and pretty good health. I also have interstitial cystitis. This is a chronically irritated bladder, but that hasn't bothered me for a long time. I don't have high blood pressure. And Kelly, let me start with saying that managing diverticulitis usually requires antibiotics. So undoubtedly, your microbiome currently is very impacted. And you're like a field that used to have a good layer of ground cover, and now you don't. Now, diverticulitis is an interesting entity. It does run in families, and it's my opinion that it's probably related to some sort of structural protein, maybe one of the collagens, and that some people just have stiffer and stronger elasticity and in their guts than others. It's also strongly associated with constipation and straining stools. And you're 72, so you've probably 73. You've probably had a few colonoscopies. And so my first question, were we in the office together, would be, did those colonoscopies show diverticulosis? Osis meaning the uninflamed diverticula, which is very similar to a hernia. Now, you've heard of inguinal hernias or abdominal hernias. And what happens in a hernia is that you get a run in the stocking. The tissue gets thinned and it gets weak, And whatever it's holding in, like a think of a mosquito net or a retaining wall, it starts to pooch out through. And of course, it's in both of the cases of those, it's the intestine that's pooching out, and it's covered with skin, and so you might have a bulge, but it's generally not going to get infected. Now, in the case of the diverticula, we have to go down a level and imagine one of those stretchy hoses that are all the rage right now. And think of that as your colon. Of course, your colon will expand and contract a great deal more than that, but just stay with me for a moment. The colon has three layers, and one of the layers is the lining, one of the layers is the muscle layer, and the next layer is the external skin. Of course, it's not really external because it's inside your abdomen, but it's the outside. So you have the endothelium and the epithelium of this colon, this stretchy tube. Now imagine that it has to stretch too much. Imagine that the rings of muscle, because there are circumferential rings of muscle, and those rings of muscle are contracting, trying to push stiff, hard stool out. Now, in doing so, they're straining the wall between the rings, and sometimes that wall just can't handle it, and so the endothelium will, and the contents of the gut will try to push out, and you'll get these little finger-like projections. If the wall is weaker than the average wall, you're going to get more of them, and that's a part of what's going on. Another thing that often happens with people who have diverticulosis is that they develop nidus, if you will, clumps of bad bacteria at the bottom of these holes, and they can be finger-like projections on the if you were to open the intestinal wall and look at them, you'll often see these sort of finger-like things coming out of the intestine out of the colon, and those can get stool trapped in them. And when the bacteria in that stool start to multiply and they can't get out, that triggers the immune system, and you end up with inflammation. And now you've got diverticulitis, which is generally treated with antibiotics. Unfortunately, prolonged courses of antibiotics, even short courses, have a really drastic effect on the microbiome. And people rebound differently, but multiple bouts of diverticulitis generally lead to a sort of monocropping of the microbiome. So instead of 1,000 different microbes, you might have 250. And some of that 250 are kind of juvenile delinquents. They really shouldn't be there, and they cause trouble, and they cause inflammation, which causes swelling, which leads to more diverticulitis because the little tubes swell shut at the opening. And so you can see it becomes a vicious cycle. I do not know what imaging has shown in you, but usually at this point, you will have had a CT scan of the abdomen. They will have looked at whether you have an area where there's a large concentration of diverticula. And it's people who have that usually have surgery recommended. So I don't know for sure that that's your situation, but typically we don't recommend surgery for just a few diverticula. But if there's a whole lot in a concentrated area that we think we can just remove and then re-anastomose, that is to say, sew the gut back together again, then we do it. It is typical that when you have a abdominal surgery where a portion of the gut is removed, there is a chance of having to wear a bag for a brief period of time. With diverticulitis surgery, the time that that happens is usually if you let the diverticulitis go too long or one of these weakened areas of wall ruptures and spills bacteria into the intestinal cavity. In that circumstance, it becomes a medical emergency. But furthermore, all of the inflammation from that ruptured diverticula, it's much greater than from a localized contained infection, and it's going to act like gluing small bits of your small intestine to areas of your large intestine, gluing bits of your intestine to the abdominal wall. And those are called adhesions. And they happen to a certain extent after any open abdominal procedure. But the absolute worst thing that can happen there is a ruptured bowel. Even a single ruptured diverticula will cause massive adhesions, and you're in for late-term complications, and we cannot fix adhesions. We don't have any technology that does that. So depending on whether you have a localized area that could be relatively easily and safely removed, this would be a situation where I would be in favor of surgery. A lot depends on things I don't know. And as I'm saying, there's different possibilities. Your family history is important in terms of why you have it. And your past history in terms of constipation is important in terms of why you have it. But that you have it is not in dispute. And so the question now is natural therapy going to be enough? And without seeing the scan, I couldn't recommend it. The things you've done, eliminating sugar and white flour, that doesn't impress me as particularly useful, honestly. Increasing fiber is one of the mainstays, and that means roughage. So, you know, people need maybe 20 grams of fiber. A person with diverticulitis or diverticulosis who's trying to keep it from getting worse needs double that amount of fiber, and the more the merrier. I tell my patients you should have horse poop. You should basically sit down and relax, and out it comes. And while it won't have quite the diameter of a horse turd, what it should have is a large volume, probably 2 or 3 poops a day. And that means high vegetable diet, lots of extra fiber, and you have to work up to that because you have to get the microbiome that's going to handle that, and you have the microbiome you feed. You can't flip it on a dime. So what you do is start increasing fiber gradually, let the microbiome shift, keep increasing it, and with that sort of a strategy, you can at least keep yourself from having more diverticulitis and more diverticula. But you may be in a loop now where you really just have to lance the boil, so to speak, and cut out the offending portion of your colon. I can't speak to this because I don't know. I can't make a recommendation, but I hope I've helped you understand what's at stake here. And I want to emphasize the fact that you have interstitial cystitis at all means, as far as I'm concerned, that you either have food sensitivities or you have a leaky gut. And so in that situation, or both, because they often go together, and in that situation, you're more vulnerable to having problems with your colon until you get that gut healed. And that's a very complicated stepwise procedure, but it can be done. So I want to give you hope. I want to encourage you to consider the surgery. Most of the time, if it's non-emergent and you haven't perforated, they can do that and hook you back up again, and you wake up without a bag. So most of the time, no guarantees. I hope this has been helpful. I'm going to move to a couple of short micro things. Let's go first to neuroimmune crosstalk in fibrosis. Now, we were talking a little bit earlier about the breast cancer and the chemical signals that are present and how our immune systems talk to each other. And this is from Science, so it's a short blurb. Organ functions can be impaired if there's dysregulation. And there's an interesting intercommunication between pain sensors and immune cells in the lungs. And so there's a disease called pulmonary fibrosis, which is a disease where you develop scar tissue in the lung. And of course, the lung has to be able to expand. And it's very, under healthy circumstances, very flexible and elastic. If the lung loses its elasticity, then it can't expand as much. So you can't take deeper breaths, which means with exercise or activity, when your body is called calling on more oxygen from the lungs, you're unable to accelerate or compensate. So what they did in this study was they genetically depleted the mice of pain receptors, which detect, in the lung at least, damaging stimuli. And then when they gave the mice something that would cause fibrosis, oddly enough, they got worse fibrosis from the same level of tissue injury. In the absence of the pain receptors, macrophages in the lungs called on those neutrophils at a higher level. So we got those neutrophil extracellular traps, those nets of inflammatory compounds that I mentioned earlier, and these may have contributed to the fibrosis. So the way to think of that is that failure to trigger the pain receptor failed to trigger a natural suppressor of inflammation. And I can't emphasize enough how much of what this signaling back and forth is accelerator, brake, brake, accelerator, and multiple different brakes and multiple different accelerators, and then they all add up to either inflammation or absence of inflammation. Let's talk about food spoilage. Those best before dates can give a sense of when a food might still be safe to consume, but they are very conservative, and it leads to premature disposal of good food, and poor handling or storage may compromise foods before they reach that use-by date. So what's an eater to do? Well, new technology, a dual-platform sensor that inserts a dye-loaded polymer into a hydrogel, and if it shows, it measures pH, so it detects those, well, the stuff that we smell that smells bad, but also it detects changes in pH, effectively becoming more acidic, that would because the bacteria are in there doing their metabolic thing and producing lactic acid. And so they found a way to make the packaging for food fluoresce and or change color. They did both. So it's essentially like a radiation badge for a film badge that you see the X-ray techs wearing. If your film badge is too overexposed, they take you off work for a month because you've had too much radiation. Well, in this case, it's a film badge for food, and particularly for things that often carry disease. I'm thinking about deli meats and lunch meats. Packaged sandwich meats, particularly if they are made of chopped up meat, very high rate of contamination with Listeria monocytogenes, and also certain dairy or milky foods, also mayonnaise, very high contamination with Staph aureus, which produces toxins that cannot be cooked away. So having those types of foods with one of these package detectors, you pull out the mayonnaise from the fridge, you take the lid off, and the lid is purple, and that's your signal not to eat the mayonnaise. So this could really cut back on diseases. It's a very promising bit of technology. Another thing you can't see, but boy, does this have me nervous, is we've all heard about Roundup and the dangers of Roundup. So the people at Monsanto, recognizing that Roundup was a liability, have gone and replaced the weed killer in Roundup with a new compound. This compound is probably even worse. It's called Diquat. And I was in a Home Depot recently, and I checked the Roundup aisle, and they all have Diquat. One study suggests that Diquat could be 200 times more toxic than glyphosate. And what Diquat does when ingested is it suppresses the proteins that protect the gut lining. Oops. It creates leaky gut, thus allowing toxins from the dead bacteria, which are supposed to stay in the gut, to leak into the bloodstream. Those toxins trigger inflammation locally, and that kills off the good bacteria. And dieguat can cause permanent kidney damage, inflammation in the liver, and an inflammatory reaction in the lungs. It's strong enough to cause multiple organ failure just from inhaling it. The stuff is quite a bit nastier. Most other countries have banned dieguat. The EU banned it 20 years ago, but we have a permissive attitude about things. And so, wow, this is definitely something to be concerned about. Let's move on to one more quickie, and that one is nightmares. Now, nightmares seem to come out of your brain, but nightmares too can come out of your gut. So people, there's kind of a thing where some people say that eating cheese will give them nightmares. Probably a lot of people haven't noticed, and it's probably a threshold effect, meaning a little bit's okay, but you pass a certain point. And researchers surveyed about 1,000 people about their sleep and eating habits, and they found that those who had a lactose intolerance, who during the day would cause GI symptoms, reported much stronger nightmares on the average as measured by frequency, the amount of distress, and how much they impacted daily activities. So the worse the lactose intolerance, the more intense the bad dreams. So the researchers coming from Montreal, where they do eat a lot of cheese, had a study group, just psychology undergraduates, of course, because they're, let's just say that they're thick on the ground at a university. And they gave it to these young people. They had them go off milk, and the frequency of the nightmares dropped substantially. Now, the exact mechanism of this isn't clear, but more than likely, the low-grade gastrointestinal discomfort that you were sleeping through interfered with deep quality sleep and led to microarousals that interrupt sleep. And so the microarousals basically help your dreams be more intense because you drop back, you arouse out of REM, and then you drop back and you're still a little more on the awake curve. So you remember the dreams and they tend to be more vivid. So if you have frequent nightmares, more than I would say a couple times a month, it might be worth going off dairy before you go see a counselor or before you go on a pharmaceutical. It might make sense to just try this simple step of no dairy and see if it helps control those bad dreams. We're coming back to our theme of more than meets the eye. In this case, remote control designer probiotics, basically more micro robots. This one, a shotgun wedding, shall we call it, between a genetically altered form of E. coli and the fabled PillCam. PillCams have been around for a while, but you know, they tumble around in there, and so it's a problem if you're trying to use it as a camera. But if you're using it as a light sensor and your partner in detection is a bacteria that's biologically adapted to emit light when it's stimulated with photons, you can get some very interesting things. So you start out with a wireless capsule endoscope, basically a pill cam, that is able to signal the bacteria using light, depending on which bacteria you put in there and how it's been altered. You could make it do things. You can also have the bacteria detect changes like inflammatory mediators in the gut and emit light that the camera would see. So there's been various engineered biological bacterial sensors in animal models, detecting signs of inflammation, dietary perturbations, even tumor DNA. And this particular E. coli NISL is one of the ones that isn't invasive. So you can use it in humans. It rarely takes up residence. So it flushes out, isn't able to persist. So that makes it very handy for doing science. And it's become the sort of lab rat E. coli of this sort of work. So You can also put into this bacteria the DNA information for making antibiotics or making anti-inflammatories or making anti-cancer agents, and also enzymes. So you could change the metabolic niche by adding an enzyme, maybe one that the person is congenitally unable to make. So very interesting in terms of research, but also in terms of actual targeted therapy with stuff that maybe can't be expected to survive passage from the mouth through the acid bath of the stomach and the enzyme bath of the small intestine to be anywhere near intact enough to do anything by the time it gets down to the colon. So one of the things that's already been done is using bioluminescence like the undersea life or also firefly, luciferin has been used. So they engineer the bacteria to produce this luminescent dye, if you will, to turn into a lightning bug when it detects nitric oxide or blood in the gut. And so there are other ones that are engineered to essentially respond to light being blinked from the pill cam. So that would turn on DNA. These are bacterial strains. They're able to make just about anything you might want to program into them. And one study, very, very interesting from the standpoint of treatment, potentially for inflammatory bowel disease. So there's some drugs, a lot of biologic drugs that we give to people and we inject them so they go all through the body. And the job of these drugs is to block tumor necrosis factor alpha. Usually these are antibodies, so they either grab this compound, which is a strong inflammatory signal, or they block the receptor for it by just like an antibody attaching to it and blocking it. It's just like the spike protein antibody blocks the docking station for the virus COVID-19. So we've got this really interesting sort of potential here with the small genetically engineered E. coli. They have figured out how to make an anti-tumor necrosis. They're calling it a nanobody, but it's basically a compound that deactivates tumor necrosis factor and so nips in the bud an inflammatory reaction, which left alone would grow into a full-blown attack of Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis. And in this case, when it was making the anti-tumor necrosis factor, it was also making green light, and the pill cans could see it. So just to think about this, you have a capsule that you swallow. It's about 33 mLs long, which makes it millimeters long, which makes it a little bit bigger than the largest 00 capsule, which is 24 millimeters long. So one problem with this is it's a big pill to swallow, literally. But for diagnosis, you basically swallow, you eat the bacteria in a mush or in a capsule, and it has it's a biosensor. So when it sees acid or it sees blood or it sees nitric oxide, it starts fluorescing. And it's just sitting there, you know, being a lightning bug. But meanwhile, as the capsule passes through, it sees the light and is able to be read by a cell phone held against the intestine. Is this positive? Yes. It's sort of like these glucose sensors that everyone's all the rage right now. But imagine that is like, okay, is this stomach ache actually my ulcerative colitis getting ready to flare up, or is it just a stomach ache? You can imagine this sort of technology being very useful, and certainly something that once established and proven could be scaled up quite easily. Now, the other thing you can do is that the LED light, the electron capsule, could receive a signal from the clinician. So back to the cell phone, you can see where the capsule is in the gut. You can tell when it gets to the descending colon and where the ulcerative colitis is. And then you can actually signal electrically from your phone to the capsule to activate a green LED light, which would then trigger the production of those anti-tumor necrosis factor nanobodies that would then the E. coli would start churning those things out like a little factory. And so, wow, right? All this happening inside the intestine, and the technology is here for little robots crawling in your, genetically altered E. coli that can basically do just about anything you can think of. It's an astonishing technology and really exciting. More than meets the eye. So this one is about plastics and microplastics. When you think about your teeth and going to the dentist every 6 months or every 4 months and having your teeth scaled, what you're actually doing is removing plaques. Plaques are basically produced by the bacteria, kind of the way that that coral polyps produce fix calcium and produce a coral reef to live in. And when you scrape up the plaques, it's the equivalent of disrupting a coral reef. And so the colonies of bacteria are displaced and they aren't able to start eating the base of your teeth where it's nice and warm, and the compounds, the acids that they release, start eroding away your gums. Well, bacteria will stick onto anything. I'm constantly cleaning bacteria biofilms off of things in my home environment. And we've been talking about microplastics, and what we've missed in the conversation so far is that there's a lot of different microplastics, and as they circulate in the environment, first of all, there's a bunch of different polymers that are used to make plastic, right? Whole bunch of different ones, nylon, polypropylene, and then there are the chemical additives. There's something like 10,000 chemical additives that are used in very small amounts in plastic for various purposes. We could think about triclosan, which was being put in soap because it would kill germs. It was very good at getting into biofilms and killing germs, but it also has screwed up algae when it got into the oceans. Microplastics essentially pick up bacteria and viruses and molds and metals, and the bacteria create a biofilm which provides a habitat and essentially allows these things to keep sticking to the plastic. It's known as the corona, after that shape, that bright light that you see around the sun in a eclipse. And because the plastics come in different shapes and carry different electric charges, where they can go and what they can do is really different. And we need to study it. We need to understand more about it. But most lab studies so far have actually used a single type of microplastic particle, a smooth polystyrene bead. And this isn't what's happening in the environment. It's not a good substitute for the stuff that's actually out there. So it's taken one lab 2 years to figure out how to make polyethylene particles, PET, and that's found in disposable water bottles, which obviously are everywhere in the environment, and they have been able to put fluorescent tags on these PETs. And this is one of the major microplastics that we should be worried about that up until now we haven't been able to track. And because it's fluorescent, they've been able to track it inside tissue. And that is huge, and we need to do more of it. We also don't have good tools to measure what the burden of microplastic is. And the usual method, and we have another breakthrough here that I'm going to tell you about, but before, what they were doing was having to take the physical tissue and look at it with a specialized microscope, and then for certain small microplastics, they would have to use chemical detection, which means melting the sample. And so in the case of dissolving the sample, I should say more accurately, they also don't, you can't see what, which cell types contained it. And so you don't really know how much was in what kind of cell. And it also is a problem because it can confuse biological molecules like lipids with plastics because they look somewhat similar. So there the studies that can be done, and there's one that was done recently about microplastics in stool and irritable bowel syndrome, they could only really test a few dozen people with irritable bowel, and that's not enough to get a good scientifically solid statistical analysis. So a new method has just come online, which is using lasers to essentially do almost a mass spectroscopy, so it can determine the composition of the microplastics by what comes back. The laser, of course, is a single coherent beam of light at one frequency, and as it bounces off the molecules of plastic, it actually is changed. Part of it's absorbed, part of it is reflected, and so the light that comes back is at a different frequency. So you can, this is analogous to how we look at the light, at the signature of light coming from stars, and in can tell what levels of what compounds are in that light. It's used for all kinds of drug research. So coming up are a bunch of studies that should be due out by the end of the year. And I'm very excited. There's one being done in Belgium and Spain looking at microplastics in the placenta, the urine, and the blood, and looking at health outcomes like premature birth and early child development. And since we know these things are ending up in the brain, and we know the brains of infants are particularly vulnerable to subtle influences such as hormonal influences, toxins, small submicron carbon particles. It's just so much that we've polluted the environment with. Another one is looking in Holland. They're looking at microplastics in household dusts and in the participants' urine, and then they're basically doing how do you keep house? How often do you vacuum? Do you dust? Do you not dust? Do you have a Roomba? And they're essentially trying to see whether there's a best practice for cleansing, whether you shouldn't sweep but you should use a suction tool, for example, comes to mind. And they're also looking at how fast do the plastics leave the body, or at least most of them, by putting people on plastic-free in plastic-free environments with diets where nothing has come in contact with plastic for a week. It's very expensive. And then they looked to see how the blood and the stool amounts of microplastics change. So all kinds of stuff that we can't see, but we're beginning to learn how to evaluate and effectively, inferentially see and study. So good stuff, a little esoteric, but I really think there's practical aspects. Okay, so we'll do this one as a quickie and give you a relief from all this science. But you heard from me about the CAR T-cell therapy for multiple myeloma, and because my husband underwent that therapy within the last year, I'm very excited about his results. It's a much kinder, gentler therapy than the previous therapy of a complete bone marrow transplant, and it's looking to be very, very effective. So the way it works is you engineer your own immune T cells, take them out of the body, and send them off to graduate school, and allow them to learn how to attack the B cells that are making the evil protein. That antigen on the B cells is called B cell mature antigen. and it works really well. The data on five-year disease-free survival is excellent. But the problem is it's expensive. You have to take those T cells out. You have to do chemotherapy. The most important thing is that maybe we don't have to do that. So a new research study is, instead of taking the cells out, they're putting these tiny lipid nanoparticles into the body, and they contain the DNA that encodes CD19 CAR, which is what destroys and attacks the B cells. So this is something where we will be able to simply, sort of like a gamma globulin shot, we'll be able to give the person a multiple myeloma shot, and their animals, it worked really well and lasts for about a month, even at the lowest doses. So this is looking very promising. It's coming in animal studies. And because we don't have to take the T cells out and we don't have to deplete what's in the bone marrow, it's going to be much cheaper, and it could have a much broader application because you can pretty much put in whatever DNA you want to. So this could be a way of going after a lot of different blood cancers, including the leukemias, in having, you know, ALL or CML. It'd make it more like having diabetes, where you had to get an injection once a month, which certainly makes it a lot more manageable. Hello, this is Dr. Motika. You're on the air.
Oh, hello, Dr. Don. It's a pleasure to talk to you there. Yeah, I have like a question to ask you.
Sure, go ahead. We've got time.
Yeah, I caught the doctor a little bit, like telling about your fiber foods, whatever. Like, and I was wondering, what could I eat to get more complete bowel movements there? Because I have borderline diabetes, and I'm trying to lose weight there, and I'm taking Wegovy on with the injection thing there, and it's kind of helping a little bit there, but it's still kind of early to tell. But I think the main thing is I'm not going to the bathroom having my stools, and I just wondered what I could eat and what I could do. And I'm not like a bachelor, and I'm into cooking too much. I just wondered, can you share something that'd be easy and
sure.
less expensive?
Yep, I can. So, first of all, you said you're not much of a cook. So,
well, I try, but, you know, for just one person, I'm a widower, so I don't
yeah.
really,
okay.
not into cooking, you know. So.
All right, so easy peasy. First one is flaxseed. So you buy whole flaxseed, and you get yourself a dedicated little coffee bean grinder. Keep the flaxseed whole in the fridge, and then take out a couple of tablespoons. You'll start with with one teaspoon, then the next day two and the three, and when you get to six teaspoons, that's the same as two tablespoons. And the dose for the flaxseed is ground up. You can mix it in with scrambled eggs. You could mix it in with yogurt. You could mix it in with applesauce. You could mix it in with mashed potatoes. See, I'm giving you lots of options here. It has a slight nutty taste. It changes the texture of the foods, but not in a really bad way. And so you could use a lot of commercial off-the-shelf products and just blend this in every day. And, you know, if you're diabetic, you're not probably eating oatmeal for breakfast. So you can use
I should, but I kind of...
Actually, if you're pre-diabetic, I would encourage you not to eat oatmeal. It's great if you're not pre-diabetic and you have high cholesterol, but once you get that pre-diabetes, it tends to feed into it. So I would say, you know, yogurt, like an unsweetened yogurt, and you buy little packages of it, and you can add your own flavorings. You could figure this out, okay? And so that's number one. The other one is maybe you could do this once a week. You could go and get a bunch of root vegetables, like a turnip, a rutabaga, a beet, a couple of carrots, maybe a parsnip, you know, just an eight by eight pan of vegetables. You peel them, you coat them in olive oil, you drop them into the oven at 350, you cook them till they're fork tender, and then you just chop it up, and you have a couple of, you know, maybe a quarter cup of that every day. You could make it in a salad. You could have it as a side vegetable. They're good cold. They're good hot. But they are full of fiber. and they're very good for your microbiome. And you probably need a better microbiome, and that will help a lot with your regularity.
Oh, wow. That sounds really grand there. Wow. It sounds like getting like an answer machine, but yet not paying for it there almost there. You know. I'm so glad you have your program on there, and I think that's really wonderful. You're helping out your average folks like myself. And I just hope one thing. I just hope our beloved Mr. Uncle Grump president there, I just hope he doesn't go too far with his environmental cuts and everything, but he's really going to mess this country up horrible. And it's like, I'm kind of really scared because I'm on like a Section 8 housing there. And if I lose that, man, I'm out in the street there. And I'm 68 years old. So it's like, you know, I'm kind of, you know, like dead in the water, you might say. And I saw it doesn't happen because there's already a bad homeless population in Santa Cruz. So it's kind of, you know, kind of scary.
I am so sorry to hear that you're, you know, right on the edge there. And I know that anxiety will worsen constipation. So do your best to be, you know, in the moment, take deep breaths, remind yourself that you're okay right now. And whatever changes, you know, let's be clear, you're in the People's Republic of California, right? So there's going to be a big effort to just ante up and make up for it at the state level, and to keep, like they've done that with the Medicaid cuts. And
yeah, that's another scary thing.
We haven't really seen any shifts in people's eligibility. And I mean, I'm plugged into that because I do a free clinic, and we haven't seen an uptick in people losing their Medi-Cal because they're just changing around the funding. And in a state the size of California, you know, we can do this. We can get through the next 3 years and take care of our people. And the people I feel sorry for are the people in the red states, because they totally didn't see this coming, and it has not worked out, I think, the way they thought it would. And I feel bad for them, especially as we're heading into hurricane season. But
Yeah, Dr. Don, I want to interrupt you for a minute there. Mm-hmm. You said you had like a free clinic out here in Santa Cruz. I heard you. I think I saw like your thing. I heard the other programs are saying you're like the head of like a free clinic around in this area, I heard.
Right. And so that's, if you will have to actually pitch in, because people who go through, who don't have health care are the ones that we're trying to reach, the people who've lost their health care.
Oh,
so
yeah.
If you've actually still got Medicare, if you're Medi, you know, I encourage you to use that resource.
Oh, yes. Yeah, yes. Definitely.
And then you can reach me through the Western Service Workers Association. You can reach that clinic if you need it and you don't have other access. But we want it for the people who really need it.
Yeah, I totally understand. I was just curious there, because I had to kind of, and I just kind of hoping to kind of meet you in person and just shake your hand and give you a big hug and just saying what a wonderful person you are.
Well, I would love to meet you too. I'm afraid we're going to have to go. Thank you for the call. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.